All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, May 23rd, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everyone. It is a sunny 61 degrees to get up to 80 today here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off on Friday? We titled the show Ticks, Lyme Disease, Powassan, Mycoplasmas and Mystery Diseases. And we had talked to Carl Grossman back about a week ago in regards to Plum Island and some of the research that had been going on there and potentially that may have gotten out. One of those happened to be Lyme disease and the ticks that are now swarming the East Coast. We found out in New Jersey that there is a never before seen here on the North American continent tick from Asia that clones itself, and it wintered over this year, and now they are warning to look out for new diseases besides Lyme, like that powassan that has no treatment, can end up in neurological disorders, and then death. We also found out that Lyme disease is no joke. It is a bacteria, not a virus, that gets into your body, and it can hide. It goes into spore form when it goes dormant, and it can come back years later with a vengeance and, again, give you neurological problems. We read that woman's story where she had written about her journey into advanced Lyme, where she was getting hallucinations and lack of coordination, and it was very difficult to survive with that type of infection. Well, the CDC just stepped up the other day, and I guess they are being slapped down by the public. This story was from May 8th of 2018, and I have a blank page right now, so hold on one second. Too bad you can't see the picture, but I will put the link to this in the notes so you can take a look at it. The CDC is now apologizing for hiding ticks on a poppy seed muffin as a public service announcement to warn of the threat of Lyme disease. May 8th, 2018 out of USA Today. It all started with a tweet from the Center for Disease Control posting a question. Ticks can be the size of a poppy seed. Can you spot all five ticks in this photo of a lemon poppy seed muffin? The attached image from last week shows a poppy seed muffin, the paragon of American breakfast pastries, with no fewer than five blood-sucking arachnids. Arachnids? Are they arachnids? So that would be like the spider family hidden on top. It is part of a CDC effort to warn Americans of the tick-borne infections, such as Lyme disease, that the agency says is on the rise. May begins the three-month span during which most people will get tick bites, more than any other in the United States, according to the CDC. And a 2016 study found that ticks carry Lyme disease and it is present in nearly half of all U.S. counties. While some 30,000 cases of Lyme disease get reported annually, the CDC suggests that the actual number of diagnosed cases may be 10 times that, and that'd be 300,000. If not treated, Lyme disease can produce severe arthritis or cause other neurological and cardiac problems. The CDC's tick-laden muffins presented an entirely distinct problem for Twitter users, left to forever associate the delicious dots on the poppy seed muffin with disease-ridden ticks. Responses ranged from, quote, "I will never be able to eat a poppy seed muffin again," to "potlucks at the CDC must be a hoot," and can't get tick bites if you are biting them. The replies, many revolted, continued, some 900 in all, and the CDC issued a tick-in-cheek apology on Monday. "Sorry we ticked some of you off. Don't let a tick bite ruin your summer." That reminds me of another public service announcement I had seen at the Kinzu Dam when I was a kid. In the bathroom, stuck on the paper towel dispenser, it says, "Don't drown, it will spoil your day." But if generating buzz about tick bites was the CDC's goal all along, it is safe to say that the agency does not regret their tweet. So he has ticks on top of a poppy seed muffin, and I took a very close look at that muffin, and I found a couple of them. But it was quite horrifying to realize how absolutely infinitesimal these nymph-sized ticks are, and they are loading the woods across the upper Northeast. So then there was another story on Healthline.com talking about chronic Lyme disease, and you'll see I have a method to my madness here. If a tick bites you, contact your doctor. It should be observed for 30 days to see if there are signs of Lyme disease. One of the early signs would be the big bullseye rash, but we found out on Friday that not all Lyme positive bites give a bullseye rash. Early signs occur 3 to 30 days from a tick bite, and I'm bringing this to you as a public service announcement. Number one is, of course, the red expanding bullseye rash at the site of the tick bite. Number two, fatigue, chills, and general illness. Number three, itching. Number four, headache. Number five, dizzy or faint feeling. Number six, muscle or joint pain or swelling. Number seven, neck stiffness. And number eight, swollen lymph nodes. Now, here is another story that we actually started on Friday titled Mycoplasma, Often Overlooked in Chronic Lyme Disease. We're going to look at a little bit of the background. We're going to get into a little bit of mycoplasmas today because mycoplasmas are everywhere. They also were implicated in Gulf War Syndrome, in chronic fatigue syndrome, and a lot of these other autoimmune, unidentifiable illnesses that have plagued the American public for the last 20 or 30 years. Very little was known about mycoplasmas at the time, and this is when Dr. Nicholson, and this is the story we're reading on Friday, was investigating his stepdaughter's illness after coming back from the Gulf War, as well as her platoon, and they had determined that it was some sort of mycoplasma infection titled Mycoplasma fermentans. As his work progressed, he looked at Brucella, Borrelia, Enrichiella, and other chronic intracellular infections that all have the potential to cause illness and present with overlapping signs and symptoms. That would be ones that are very difficult to diagnose. In Gulf War veterans that were being evaluated, approximately 45% of those had a mycoplasma infection. And it was found that the infection was of a particular type of mycoplasma, and that would be the Mycoplasma fermentans. Very little was known about this particular species at the time, except that the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology and the Army have been doing research on the organism. Once this likely causative agent in Gulf War illness had been identified in about half of the Gulf War cases, Dr. Nicholson recommended that mycoplasma-infected Gulf War veterans be treated with doxycycline. So they treated them with antibiotics. Just years earlier in Texas, prisons also emerged in which many of the inmates and guards had come down with neurodegenerative conditions at rates that were far from ordinary. In Huntsville, Texas, where three large state prisons are found, there were about 70 cases of ALS, numerous cases of multiple sclerosis, and highly unexpected numbers of rheumatoid arthritis cases. At that time, the term mystery disease was used to identify the unusual illnesses that so many seem to have acquired. Dr. Nicholson, and this was in this Project Daylily book, started testing prison guards and their family members and found that very high numbers of these same people were testing positive for Mycoplasma fermentans, just like the Gulf War veterans. Furthermore, there appeared to be a weaponized version of the organism called Mycoplasma fermentans incognitus, which was a specific strain of mycoplasma that had been altered to cause more severe symptoms, thus be more virulent, and to be more survivable than the naturally occurring fermentas. Dr. Nicholson believed that the biological weapons experiment had been carried out on inmates in Texas for years, in which humans had been used as guinea pigs, and maybe even during the Gulf War. Now, at the end of Friday's show, I also mentioned Jim Mars, who was an American journalist, as well as a best-selling New York Times best-selling author, who wrote a large range of books on alleged cover-ups and conspiracies. He was very well known in the JFK conspiracy circles, and Oliver Stone's JFK film was actually based upon one of his books. Well, Jim Mars had also written a publication called The Trillion Dollar Conspiracy that I ran across the other day, and I spent quite a bit of time cutting and pasting excerpts from the book that had taken a look at the history of weaponizing mycoplasmas and Plum Island, as well as Fort Detrick, Maryland. So this is out of Trillion Dollar Conspiracy under a section titled Mycoplasmas and Prions. In the early 1940s, Nazi medical scientists had managed to isolate the bacterial toxin from Brucella bacteria, which is known as brucellosis, and it is found especially in mammals and cows, and form it into a crystalline form of the agent. We had read an excerpt of this before. Brucellosis is an ancient bacteria and was selected because it was insidious and very difficult to detect and present in almost every organ and system in the human body. But when it was activated by the crystalline agent, brucellosis, stimulated various diseases that prompted a variety of symptoms, including debilitating fatigue, high fever, shivering, aching, drenching sweats, headache, backache, weakness, and depression. Major damage to organs is possible, leading to ailments such as multiple sclerosis, arthritis, and heart disease. These paperclip medical scientists that came to America brought with them this toxin, known as a mycoplasma, ding ding, a distinct type of bacteria that lacks a cell wall. A U.S. government report dating back to January 3, 1946, carried a section entitled Production and Isolation for the First Time of a Crystalline Bacterial Toxin. This Nazi bug had been reduced to the crystalline form, creating an artificial virulent disease agent derived from the original bacteria. This crystalline bacteria agent could be dispensed by aerial spraying or by infecting insects. So they've discovered mycoplasma as a co-infection to Lyme, and now we find out that back in the 1940s, the paperclip scientists were messing around with a mycoplasma that could be crystallized and put into an insect. Ding, ding, ding. The agent also did not respond to most antibiotics, including penicillin, though Dr. Nicholson had found that some of the infections that he was treating did react to doxycycline. And I don't know enough about antibiotics to tell you what is different about doxycycline from penicillin. But make a note of that if someone wants to get into some research and knows something about biology that might be kind of fun. Acting as a parasite, and that would be the mycoplasma, it stimulated both bacterial and viral diseases. And because it attached to specific cells without killing them, it was virtually undetectable by conventional medical diagnosis techniques. So it was very stealth, and that would be the incognitus. Such diseases are considered untreatable and usually fatal because they mostly affect the brain or the neural tissue. These subviral bacterium particles have various names. They've been termed prions, though we've discovered that prions are also malformed proteins by Nobel Prize winner Dr. Stanley Prusner, as well as stealth viruses by Dr. John Martin of the Center for Complex Infectious Diseases, amyloids by the Dr. late Carlton Jadczuk, winner of the 1976 Nobel Prize in Medicine for his work on mysterious epidemics at the National Institute of Health, and mycoplasma brucellosis by Donald Scott and Garth Nicholson. And that would be Dr. Nicholson that we had read about from Project Daylily. According to papers by Stanley Prusin, prions are unprecedented infectious pathogens that cause fatal neurodegenerative diseases by the entirely novel mechanism of altering proteins in the body. And now, wouldn't it make you feel better to know that they are creating synthetic proteins in the laboratory as the cures to many diseases? Prion diseases may present as genetic, infectious, or sporadic disorders, all of which involve modification of the prion protein, wrote Prusner. paperclip scientists working on these infectious organisms, so that's got to make you feel good as well. We're based primarily in the laboratories of Fort Detrick, Maryland, ding ding, as well as Cold Spring Harbor, New York. And that's one that I got to ask Carl about. I haven't heard about Cold Spring until I read this publication. As well as the Edgewood Arsenal in Maryland, it was here and in hundreds of other laboratories throughout America down long dark hallways that immediately after World War II, our former enemy scientists were brought in under Operation Paperclip to continue their research and development of some of the most horrible weapons of mass destruction known to mankind. Says noted molecular researchers Garth and Nancy Nicholson in their 2005 book titled Project Daylily. Ding, ding. The husband and wife molecular researchers also noted that there are over 200 species of mycoplasmas, and most are innocuous and do no harm, and there are only four or five that are pathogenic. Mycoplasma fermentans, which would be including the E. cognita strain, probably come from the nucleus of the Brucella bacterium, and this disease agent is not a bacteria, and nor it is a virus. It is a mutated form of the Brucella bacterium combined with a Visna virus from which the mycoplasma is then extracted, they said. The little mycoplasma also lost some of its genetic information, such as the genes that encode the thick cell wall and the other genes that encode certain enzymes for its metabolic pathways. Thus, it is smaller than the most common bacteria, without a distinctive cell wall found in most bacteria, and it can take on a variety of morphologies. Oh, look, it's shape-shifting. Wow, now we know DARPA's been working on things like that. It must hide inside of the animal or the human cell to survive, and although originally thought to be fairly fragile, these little mycoplasmas are hardier than anyone has ever imagined. Although considered primitive by bacteriological standards, the mycoplasmas actually evolved from bacteria that contained cell walls, but then it lost its ability to make its own cell wall, probably because it is no longer needed when it hides inside of host cells and tissues. But it made up for the loss of some genetic information by having evolved with other genetic sequences that allowed it to enter and colonize cells just like viruses do. Remember, we looked at the lytic cycle of viruses. I think that was on Friday, maybe it was last Wednesday, but it was not a virus because it retained the genetic and the biochemical remnants of the bacteria. But like a virus, however, it damaged the cells by interfering with some of the cells' biochemical cycles, and it encoded some nasty molecules that caused invaded cells to slowly self-destruct and die, says the Nicholsons, noting that important targets inside the cells were mitochondria, which would be your cellular batteries that produce the cell's energy and DNA. The Nicholsons explain that biological warfare research conducted between 1942 and now has created a more deadly and infectious form of the mycoplasma. Continuing the work of Nazi scientists, researchers in the United States weaponized the mycoplasmas by reducing the pathogen to be a synthesized crystalline form. And they later tested it on an unsuspecting public in North America. According to the Nicholsons, the U.S. military's fascination with building this kind of biological weapon lies in the fact that the creature will hide inside of cells and cause unbelievable havoc. It'll destroy the mitochondria, eventually sending the cells into an unrelenting death program. And in the process, gene expression will go crazy and the surrounding cells will become damaged. This bug then escapes from its dying host cells to go on to other places to eventually colonize every organ. And because pieces of the cellular membrane are dislodged when this very little mycoplasma leaves its cellular hiding place, its victim should also be presented with an array of autoimmune symptoms similar to those found in various degenerative illnesses. It may even mimic some neurodegenerative diseases. It's beautiful because it should cause diseases such as multiple sclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis, but no one will ever guess that it's being caused by an infection. Most physicians will never figure this out. What a delightful weapon. And that was a quote from the book. Several researchers, including the Nicholsons, Dr. Leonard G. Howitz, Dr. Joseph S. Pulo, and the authors of the Brucellus Triangle, Donald W. and William L. C. Scott, have linked this mycoplasma pathogen to a host of increasingly common neurosystemic diseases such as Alzheimer's, bipolar, Crohn's colitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, Krupchev-Jacobs, which is brain-wasting disease, diabetes, dysphoria, fibromyalgia, Huntington's disease, lupus, Lyme disease, multiple sclerosis, myalgic encephalomyelitis, Parkinson's disease, and even schizophrenia. Some strains of mycoplasmas are now being blamed also for cancer and for AIDS. And according to the chief virologist for the pharmaceutical company Merck Sharp and Dohaim, the late Dr. Maurice Hillman, this disease agent is now being carried by everybody in North America and possibly most people throughout the world. Ding-a-ling-a-ling, the invasion already happened, people. Mycoplasma researchers claim that many people today suffering from various neurological diseases are actually ill with brucellosis. And that would be mycoplasmas from the brucellosis. That would be crystalline brucellosis. However, because the disease toxin pathogen has been isolated from source bacterium in a crystalline form, there is no blood or tissue that will test to confirm this fact. Weaponized mycoplasmas generate ammonias that are deposited into the infected cell nuclei, and these nasty beasts intertwine with the genetic machinery in the intracellular rather than intercellular. Other infectious agents are involved with the inflicted individual. And these agents are usually mosaics of naturally occurring bacteria and viruses, and the effect upon the afflicted individual depends upon the individual's genetic predisposition and immunological makeup, and that would be the strength of their immune system, which is already decimated by the pre-existing infection. Each person is affected differently by the infection, but all afflicted individuals share a constellation of symptoms. We have a survey that describes 120 signs and symptoms, says Dr. Nancy Nicholson. And in the case of pathogenic mycoplasmas that we investigated, we found that the HIV envelope gene associated with mycoplasmas, this gene renders the mycoplasmas more deadly. I have also wondered how many people that have been diagnosed with HIV actually have chronic chimeric, which would be a mosaic of a mycoplasma bacteria in HIV itself. Reportedly, there are 10 strains of HIV. HIV-1 promotes AIDS. HIV-2 does not promote AIDS, and other 8 HIV strains are included in the biowarfare arsenal. The pathogenic mycoplasma can promote non-HIV AIDS that mimics the symptoms, but no one will talk about this, says Nancy. The mycoplasmas have been genetically engineered with pieces of genetic material from other pathogens such as Brucella. These mycoplasmas are also cofactors with Lyme disease, ding ding, and all these emerging diseases correlate to biowarfare experiments conducted during the Cold War that went seriously awry. Remember, the U.S. did approximately 208 open-air tests on the U.S. population without their knowledge or their consent over a 30-year period. And I think there's another story lined up here about some of that. It is possible that the crystalline disease toxins from the pathogens is one of the mycoplasma species, a technological feat accomplished by the U.S. military biochemical researchers working with Nazi paperclip scientists. In 1946, the director of the War Research Service, Dr. George W. Merck, reported the possibility of using crystalline toxins to Secretary of War Robert P. Patterson. It should be noted that War Research Service was initiated as America's Biological Weapons Program, and then Merck went on to become the president of Merck & Company Pharmaceuticals. According, although Merck died in 1957, his early knowledge of the disease toxin means that it could have been passed along to his colleagues at Merck Pharmaceuticals. And that Merck was involved in such research can be seen in a New England Journal of Medicine article that noted that the study of hepatitis B vaccine used exclusively in gay and drug-addicted communities was supported by, quote, a grant from the Department of Virus and Cell Biology of Merck, Sharp, and Doheim Research Laboratories in West Point, Virginia. So now I'm going to take a step further, because there are two stories here. This first one is titled Detection. Actually, I think we might want to go to this one first. This first one is titled Potential Mycoplasma Contaminants, Inactivation During Production of Inactivated Egg-Based Viral Vaccines. Mycoplasmas comprise the class of broadly distributed, wall-less living free bacteria with one of the smallest known genomes supporting bacterial self-replication. While many mycoplasmas are commensal colonizing a wide range of plants, insects, reptilian, avian, mammalian, and human hosts, a number of mycoplasma species are pathogenic and cause disease in their natural hosts. Mycoplasmas, particularly species of the genera Mycoplasma and Archaeoplasma, are also frequent contaminants of vaccine substrates, which would be continuous cell lines and less frequently animal-derived tissues. And this presents a serious concern regarding the risk of mycoplasma contamination in research laboratories and commercial facilities developing and manufacturing cell-derived biological and pharmaceutical products. So now let's take a step to the next story. Titled Detection of Mycoplasmas in Biopharmaceutical Vaccines and Gene Cell Therapies. Ding, ding, ding. So it appears that there has been a lot of contamination, and I had read in another publication that I think it was up until 1990 before they even started testing vaccinations for mycoplasma co-infections. Mycoplasma are a form of bacteria. They're characterized by an absence of a cell wall surrounding the cell membrane. We read that already. This renders them inert from many familiar antibiotics, including beta-lactams, whose activity relies on cell wall disruption. Many different mycoplasmas are pathogenic in humans, but they are also commonly found as contaminants in cell cultures. Although contamination does not create turbidity, factors such as cell line growth rates and viral vaccine productions can be adversely affected. This clearly poses a problem for processes that involve cell cultures, and thus being able to detect them is important. Mycoplasmas are too small to be seen under a standard lab microscope, yet the contamination problem is significant, and colonization by mycoplasmas is notoriously laborious and is a lengthy process to detect by conventional culture methods. A 2009 study indicated that half of all lab scientists failed to check for a presence of mycoplasmas in their cell culture, which is problematic as this contamination can disrupt patterns of gene expression. And that would be human gene expression. So they have only half of the labs have ever been checking them since 2009, and it can disrupt patterns of human gene expression. Despite the challenges, it is vital that cell cultures are tested for mycoplasma contamination if biopharmaceuticals make their way to meet regulatory guidelines. The U.S. Code of Federal Regulation, the FDA points to consider the International Conference on Harmonization, and both the European and the U.S. Pharmacopoeia all lay out technical documentation for the detection of mycoplasmas. two pharmacopoeia techniques rely on agar broth cultures to detect cultivatable mycoplasma, along with an indicator cell culture assay, which detects fastidious mycoplasmas. I don't know if we're going to like go through, because we don't really get into lab techniques. In summary, the detection of mycoplasma contamination is of the utmost concern in biotherapeutic and gene manufacturing. And now that streamlined assay validation procedures and GMP validated NAT tests are readily available, these methods can provide manufacturers with confidence in results required in production and batch release of products. The high reproducibility and the fast throughput of cutting-edge methods reduces the amount of time needed for development, because it was such a pain in the ass to test for them before, and safety testing and final marketing of novel biotechnology products. Well, phew! So maybe they're testing, maybe they're not. Who the hell knows? So we found out that there's lots of mad science gone mad that is going on in laboratories, and maybe, just maybe, they're watching, but maybe not. Well, check this out. May 16th, 2018, and this was a story that the first line started with "never before seen," which always gets my attention. New smallpox-related virus found lurking in Texas rodents. We're going to talk about some mad science and things that maybe escaped, maybe did not. Maybe it's just climate change. It's in our environment. A never-before-seen virus that is a relative of the notorious smallpox virus has been found lurking in rodents in Texas, according to a new study. Now, what didn't we just read about some sort of monkey pox or camel pox or cow pox or something that one of the labs was tinkering with, and they had ordered online, and everybody was screaming because they published their results on how to make some sort of pox virus, even though smallpox has been eradicated since the 90s or something. Researchers have discovered a new virus in pygmy mice in East Central Texas. A genetic analysis reveals that a virus was a type of pox virus, which was a family of diverse viruses that include the smallpox virus. But the new pathogen was quite different from any of the other known pox viruses. Researchers dubbed this brand new, had never before seen virus, the Brazo pox virus, because the infected mice were found at sites near the Brazos River, which runs through East Central Texas. It is still unclear whether this new virus can infect people, and right now there is no need for the public to worry, wink, says senior study author Dr. Sarah Hamer, an associate professor and director of the Shubat Avian Health Center at Texas A&M University of Veterinary Integrative Biosciences. However, this is still yet another example of a potentially emerging virus in wildlife with unknown ability to be transmitted to humans and unknown impacts to human health. Certainly, there are related pox viruses that can be devastating for human health, and many can live in animals. So indeed, although the variola virus, which causes smallpox, was declared eradicated from the world in 1980, pox viruses continue to pose a threat to humans. In particular, there was a rise in the cases of monkeypox, which is also closely related to smallpox, in parts of Africa since the 1980s, wink. And the natural hosts of monkeypox remain unknown, though maybe you'd think they'd be monkeys, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And in 2013, two men in the country of Georgia, and that wouldn't be the country of Georgia where we have secret biolaboratories, were found to be infected with a newfound pox virus, which they likely contracted from contact with cattle. Yeah, that's like the fruit bat in the one tree in Africa for Ebola. And although there may be a perception of emerging diseases coming from global hotspots such as Africa and Asia, these new findings are an example of a novel virus circulating, quotes, here in the natural areas and in our very own backyard. Not that there isn't any crazy research going on down in Texas anywhere. No, no, no. In some long, dark hallway in some government-funded laboratory. Nah. You know, it's just got to make you wonder. So then there's another one here. And I think I might have a little too many tabs open, so it's taking a while for this page to load. But this one's out of CBS.com. Come on. I don't want to have to sing. Oh, this is taking long. All right, here we go. May 15th, 2018. CBS.com, CBSNews.com. Deadly new pig virus could pose threat to humans, say researcher. Don't worry, they've been worrying about a pandemic for a while. Researchers have identified a new pig virus that could be a threat to humans. The virus was able to find its way into laboratory culture cells of people and other species, a discovery that now raises concern about a potential outbreak that could affect humans. CBS Pittsburgh reports researchers at Ohio State University and Ulbricht University in the Netherlands collaborated to better understand this new virus, which is identified as a porcine delta coronavirus. Their study appears online in the journal PNAS. Scientists say that the virus was first discovered in pigs in China in 2012, but it was not associated with the disease. It was first detected in the United States in 2014 during a diarrhea outbreak in Ohio pigs. I remember that, actually. And it has been detected in other countries as well. Pigs infected with this virus can experience acute diarrhea and vomiting that may be fatal. And I remember there was a disease back a few years ago that was affecting piglets as well. There were lots of them dying. And it was very similar to that. They were concerned about emerging coronaviruses and worried that the harm they can do to animals and their potential to jump to humans. There have been no cases of illnesses documented from this virus in humans yet, but scientists are concerned that because of the virus's similarity to SARS and MERS, that would be severe acute respiratory syndrome that they had in China, chickens, and MERS virus that they had in camels in the Middle East, two other viral diseases that originated in animals and went on to kill people. And remember, definition point number one of a pandemic is something that typically jumps from animals to humans. Salif says that for now, the porcine delta coronavirus has only affected human cell cultures in a laboratory, but no actual people have been sick. The virus was also able to bind to the receptors in cells from cats and from chickens. Scientists say that the next step is working to understand the virus and its potential infection in humans and looking for antibodies in the blood that would serve as a rapid test for evidence that the pig virus has previously infected people. So look out for that one. In mice, we have the smallpox virus in mice and now a porcine virus in pigs that both potentially could maybe infect humans. And here's a new one. This is called HTLV-1. Why doctors are worried about a virus you've likely never heard of. And there's going to be lots of these coming, trust me. Doctors from around the world are now urging the World Health Organization to pay closer attention to a deadly virus that has been dubbed the cousin of HIV, but one that has mostly been ignored. It is called HTLV-1, or human T-cell leukemia virus type 1. And although it was discovered nearly 40 years ago, most people have never likely heard of it. But that is because the virus is still relatively rare in Canada. But in Australia, it is spreading at an astounding rate, according to the Global Virus Network, a coalition of the world's foremost virologists. The group's member worry that the virus will spread more widely if it isn't done, and that would be testing, and calling for the World Health Organization to take action. Dr. Isaac Bogetch, an infectious disease specialist in Toronto General Hospital, said that the medical community still understands very little about this cancer-causing virus. And there are lots of cancer-causing viruses out there. One would be Epstein-Barr virus that many of us were exposed to in our youth. And the other would be HPV, which there are many different strains of HPV, all of which, including Epstein-Barr, are part of the herpes family and become integrated with your DNA. The reasons we don't know a lot about this virus, and this would be the HTLV-1, is because a vast majority of those with the virus have no symptoms whatsoever. And that is also true about some of these other persistent chronic viral infections. Only about 5% of those infected develop symptoms, or more accurately, complications of the virus, and those would be complications including certain type of cancers. In fact, they call HTLV-1 one of the most potent human carcinogens responsible for rare blood-based forms of lymphoma called adult T-cell leukemia lymphoma. It also leads to paralyzing neurological disorders, and it suppresses the immune system, leaving carriers open to potentially fatal infections. Ding-a-ling. So we've never heard of it. It's probably passing in the blood supply and through spittle, saliva, and bodily fluids. But nobody has ever heard of it. It also leads to other disorders. Recent research has shown that the virus is spreading, particularly among Indigenous people of Australia, where as many as 40% of the men have tested positive. Currently, the highest known prevalence is in Japan, but there are also clusters of infection on several islands in the Caribbean, Brazil, Peru, and in Central America. In all, 10 to 20 million people already worldwide may be infected. No one is entirely sure why this virus has specific pockets all over the world. And because there is no cure or vaccine against HTLV-1, virologists are calling on the World Health Organization for steps in promoting ways to stop its spread. Like HIV, HTLV-1 originated in non-human primates. Oh, really? And it spreads much the same way through infected blood and bodily fluids. The virus can be transmitted through shared needles, through breastfeeding, and through sexual activity. The risk of transmission can be reduced much the same way HIV is, by not sharing needles, using protection during sex, and by screening blood and organ donations for the virus. There are now excellent tests to spot the virus, and what's needed is simply more testing. So far, Japan is the only country that has a national screening program for HTLV-1, and Dr. Bogetch says that needs to change. It is really important to know who has the virus and who doesn't, because if people do have the virus, they can be counseled about the potential complications. So if there are issues, they can seek medical attention early. Right, and because they'll end up with some raging cancer for which there is no cure, just because they have some virus that they don't know anything about and no one ever told them about. And this is unbelievable. And guys, as I dig more and more into virology and some of the crazy stuff that's out there, I am just really shocked and awed by the things that they are discovering and all these infections that a large majority of the public have and may not even know it. So here we go. The Congo is now warning of a quote-unquote new phase. Yes, it has entered a new phase in Ebola outbreaks, after cases have been detected in a city with 1 million residents. And I think maybe we hit on this on Friday. The latest occurrence of the deadly virus is linked to 23 deaths in the Central African country. An Ebola outbreak in the Congo has entered a new phase after a case was detected for the very first time in a city of 1 million people, the country's government has said. You know, I was thinking about this. Could this potentially be a trial run? That a lot of the people who have economic interest in an outbreak could be sitting back and watching with fascination to see how fast things spread and what type of responses they could launch. So far, 23 deaths linked to the Democratic Republic of Congo's latest outbreak of the deadly virus occurred in more isolated areas, giving authorities a better chance of keeping the disease at bay. But the first urban case to be announced found in the northwest city of Mbanga threatens to change all that. The World Health Organization, which on Wednesday deployed the first experimental vaccines, ding ding, in the vast Central African country, step right up for your experimental vaccine, has expressed concern about the disease reaching Mbanga, which would make the outbreak far harder to tackle. Adding to the concerns is the city's location on the banks of the Congo River, a major thoroughfare for trade and transport, which would be to a city of Kinshasa, which is a city of 10 million people. The Congo Republic is on the other side of the river. We are entering a new phase of the Ebola outbreak that is now affecting three health zones, including an urban health zone. And since the announcement of the alert in Mpanda, our epidemiologists are working in the field to identify people who have been in contact with suspected cases. Now, I covered that because, of course, Ebola was where it started a few years ago, where we had our first homeland case. And in New Jersey, I wrote a story about this. The scientist that had come back that was put into forced quarantine. Guys, they've been warning for a while about some sort of horrible pandemic, and DARPA has been working on all kinds of different mad science gone mad. They now have that Pandemic X, giving people who participate 2 months to stop Pandemic X from taking hold. I ran across a story yesterday, I believe, titled Congo Ebola Outbreak May Be an Eligible Event for Pandemic Cat Bond and Swaps Investments. I was like, what? Bond investments? Well, listen to this. Remember we found out that the rich get richer, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, whether or not markets are going up or down, and disaster capitalism. Well, here we go. This is a really sick case. The worsening outbreak of Ebola virus in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which we just read about, may be considered an eligible event under the terms of the Class B pandemic swaps and pandemic catastrophe bonds that were issued by the World Bank to support the financing of the Pandemic Emergency Financing Facility. The outbreak first came to light just over a week ago when the World Health Organization, who is the reporting source for the Pandemic Emergency Financing Facility capital market transactions, says that it had confirmed two cases out of the total 32 Ebola virus disease cases. Since then, the outbreak has worsened. And in its latest report issued yesterday, the World Health Organization says that it has recorded three confirmed Ebola cases, 20 probable and 21 suspected, along with 23 deaths at a rate of 52% out of the cumulative total of 44 Ebola virus disease cases. Now, wait a minute. Did I just read that they only confirmed three Ebola cases? So it sounds to me like they are inflating these numbers at this present time. They are bringing in experimental vaccinations, and they are launching bonds and swaps, derivative swaps for investors to finance all this. The report, the WHO said that the laboratory-confirmed cases have been identified in the city of Minbanka, which is a city of roughly 1.5 million people. And given the discovery of this Ebola case in the city of Minbanka, the WHO has increased the assessment of public health risk to a very high at the national level and very, very high at the regional level. And the city is an urban center with major national and international rivers, roads, and domestic air routes. So the heightened risk of spread both within the Democratic Republic of Congo and its neighboring countries. A meeting is set to be held by the World Health Organization director to provide advice on whether the current Ebola outbreak constitutes a public health event of international concern. Ebola is covered under peril under the Class B tranches of pandemic swaps and cap bonds issued through the pandemic emergency financing, sorry, they're using acronyms, so I had to scroll up to see what it meant, transaction by the World Bank International for Reconstruction and Development. It appears that it also could be deemed an eligible event under the terms of transaction, although it is still probably too early to tell in the outbreak for this to be formally announced, and further spread of the disease would need to be seen first. The issuance saw $320 million of capital at risk notes sold to investors through the pandemic cat bond issuance and another $105 million of pandemic link risk swap derivatives were also sold to investors to expand the transaction for those seeking a different risk-linked assets. Holy shit. Another $95 million Series 12 Class B tranche of the pandemic cat bond notes cover a range of pandemic perils, including coronavirus, Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever, flevovirus, Lassa fever, Rift Valley fever, with Ebola falling within the flevovirus category. So make sure we have pandemics of any of these other ones, and we can launch more investor high-risk assets for you to put your money in. And at the moment, the number of confirmed deaths remains well below the trigger point for Class B pandemic catastrophe bonds and notes and related swaps, but we're chomping at the bit, so don't worry about it, which can only begin payout for a flevovirus like Ebola once the confirmed death toll passes 250 people. Oh my God. So they actually have a number of dead before they can pass payout. So you're putting your investment in hoping at least 250 people lose their lives so you can increase your investment. This is horrifying. So guys, they're not looking out for you. They're not hoping your little Johnny gets better. They're hoping your little Johnny dies so they can make money. Oh, the available information for the WHO suggests that this Ebola outbreak will be an eligible event under the terms of pandemic cap bond notes and swaps, putting the investors in the instrument on watch and effectively heightening the risk as the confirmed death rate from the outbreak raises. All right. So now let's take another step further, because as all this mad science is being accidentally released or getting out on purpose, there's another one. This is out of the Imperial College London, May 16th, 2018. Not only do we have antibiotic resistance, we have them looking at phages or phages, bacteriophages, as a way to combat it. We now also have resistance to antifungal drugs that could lead to disease and global food shortages. So put on a seatbelt, because they also trade derivatives on global food shortages. Growing levels of resistance to antifungal treatments could lead to increased disease outbreaks and affect food security around the world. And maybe we will get Camille on one of these days to talk about food security and some of the things they have waiting in the wings to take care of the loss of our food crops if some disease accidentally or on purpose happens to strike. Remember the stuff that they were looking at on Plum Island. A team of international teams led by researchers from Imperial College London and the University of Exeter, also in England, warns that improvements are needed in how existing drugs are used, as well as an increased focus on the discovery of new treatments in order to avoid a quote-unquote global collapse in our ability to control and fight fungal infections. The rise in resistance to antifungal treatment mirrors the well-established threat of bacteria, which have also become resistant to antibiotics. Common fungal infections include blights, which affect food crops, as well as yeast, and mold-related infections in humans and livestock, which can be fatal for those with underlying conditions, such as weakened immune systems. Ding, ding, ding. Step up, because here comes the global warming pandemic. Researchers say that many drugs used to treat fungal infections in plants and animals are in danger of becoming ineffective and fear the same could happen in those treatments used for humans. The findings are reported in a review paper published in the special edition of Journal Science and highlight the unprecedented rise of emerging strains of fungi which are resistant to common antifungal drugs. According to the author, overuse of existing antifungal chemicals is helping resistance to spread, and it is increasingly rendering treatments ineffective, and it could lead to a global increase in human fungal diseases, as well as an increase in loss of food crops and livestock due to fungal pathogens. Professor Fisher says that the scale of the problem has been, up until now, under-recognized and underappreciated, but the threat to human health and the food chain are serious and immediate. Alongside drug discovery and new technologies to tackle fungal pathogens, we urgently need better stewardship in existing antifungals to ensure that they are used correctly and that they remain effective. So, what is driving drug resistance? Something called an azole. Azole believed to account for a quarter of the fungicides used in agriculture, but they are also used as a first-line antifungal in the clinic. Their widespread use is thought to be increasing antifungal resistance by selectively killing off non-resistant strains, while those more resistant to the remaining two fungicides remain. The danger to human health is when resistance occurs in species such as Aspergillus fumigatus, which is a mole which thrives on decaying vegetation, but they are also able to infect those with compromised immune systems, such as cancer patients or those who have mycoplasma infections or Epstein-Barr virus or autoimmune diseases, or those who have received organ transplants. According to researchers, in addition to the use of more selective drugs and focusing on the development of new drugs, treatments aimed at silencing genes of fungi to stop them could be used, and even seem to be used to fight pathogens.